Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America, and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. During the last show, I started the concept of building a bridge towards a new Bretton Woods. There was a quote from the wonderful Wizard of Oz, The Journey to the Great Oz, which went like this, quote, "Suddenly they came to another gulf across the road. They sat down to consider what they should do, and after serious thought, the Scarecrow said, 'Here is a great tree standing close to the ditch. If the woodman can chop it down so that it will fall to the other side, we can walk across it easily.' 'That is a first-rate idea,' said the lion. 'One would almost suspect you had brains in your head instead of straw.'" Close quote. In his 1911 book, The Purchasing Power of Money, Irving Fisher wrote that for money to serve as a unit of account, a trusted medium of exchange, and a reliable store of value, its purchasing power needs to be stable. But substances existing by the bounty of nature, such as gold or silver, cannot have that property because their values fluctuate with changing supply and demand. To avoid the disastrous devaluations caused by international currency speculation, governments need a single stable peg against which they can value their currencies. Some independent measure in which merchants can negotiate their contracts and be sure of getting what they bargained for. Gold served as such a peg historically, but was an imperfect solution because the value of gold itself fluctuated widely and because gold also traded as a currency, causing the global banker, that is the United States, to eventually come up short. Some unit of value is needed that can stand as a lighthouse, resisting currency movements because it is independent of them. But what? The relationship between feet and meters can be fixed because the ground on which they are measured is solid. But world trade ebbs and flows in a moving sea of currency values. A solution devised in the experimental cauldron of 18th century America was to measure the value of paper currency against a variety of goods. During the American Revolution, troops were often paid with continentals, which quickly depreciated as the economy was flooded with them. Meanwhile, goods were becoming scarce, causing prices to shoot up. By the time the continental soldiers came home from a long campaign, the money in which they had paid was nearly worthless. To ease the situation, the Massachusetts Bay Legislature authorized the state to trade the Continentals for Treasury certificates valued in terms of the sale price of staple commodities. The certificates provided that soldiers were to be paid in the then current money of the said state in a greater or lesser sum as 5 bushels of corn, 68 pounds and 4/7 parts of a pound of beef, 10 pounds of sheep's wool, and 16 pounds of sole leather, shall then cost more or less than 130 pounds current money at the then current prices of said articles. To make that simple, there was a value in terms of the sale price of the staple commodities that was set. Nearly 2 centuries later, John Maynard Keynes had a similar idea. Instead of pegging currencies to the price of a single precious metal, gold, they could be pegged to a basket of commodities, wheat, oil, copper, and so forth. Keynes did not elaborate much on this solution, perhaps because the world economy was not then troubled by wild currency devaluations, and because the daily statistical calculations would have been hard to make in the 1940s. But that would not be a problem now. As Michael Robotham observes, with today's sophisticated trading data, we could literally have a register of all global traded commodities used to determine currency values. Robotham called Keynes' proposal a profound and democratic idea that is vital to any future sustainable and just world economy. He wrote, quote, "Today, wheat grown in one country may, due to a devalued currency, cost a fraction of wheat grown in another. This leads to the country in which the wheat is cheaper becoming a heavy exporter, regardless of need, or the capacity to produce better quality wheat in other locations. In addition, currency values can change dramatically, and the situation can reverse. Critically, such wheat prices bear no relation to genuine comparative advantage of climate, soil type, geography, and even less to indigenous local regional needs. Neither does it have any stabilizing element that would promote a long-term stability of production with relation to need. By imputing value to a nation's produce and allowing this to determine the value of a nation's currency, one is imputing value to its resources, its laborers, and acknowledging its own needs." Close quote. An international trade unit could be established that consisted of the value of a basket of commodities broad enough to be representative of national products and prices and to withstand the manipulations of speculators. This unit would include the price of gold and other commodities, but it would not actually be gold or any other commodity, and it would not be a currency. It would just be a yardstick for pegging currencies and negotiating contracts. A global unit for pegging value would allow currencies to be exchanged across national borders at exact conversion rates, just as miles can be exactly converted into kilometers, and watches can be precisely set when crossing international date lines. Exchange rates would not be fixed forever, but they would be fixed everywhere. Changes in exchange rates would reflect the national market for real goods and services, not the international market for currencies. Like in the Bretton Woods system, that pegged currencies to gold, there would be no room for speculation or hedging. But the peg would be more stable than in the Bretton Woods system, and because it would not trade as a currency itself, it would not be in any danger of becoming scarce. And I'll return in a moment after station identification. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's talk about the private basket of commodities models. To implement such a standard globally would take another round of Bretton Woods negotiations, which might not happen anytime soon. But private exchange systems have been devised on the same model, which are instructive in the meantime for understanding how such a system might work. Community currency advocate Tom Greco has designed a credit clearing exchange that expands on the LETS system. It involves an exchange of credits tallied on a computer without resorting to physical money at all. Values are computed using a market basket standard. The system is designed to provide merchants with a means of negotiating contracts privately in international trade units, which are measured against a basket of commodities rather than in particular currencies. Greco writes, quote, "The use of a market basket standard rather than a single commodity standard has two major advantages. First, it provides a more stable measure of value since fluctuation in the market price of any single commodity is likely to be greater than the fluctuation in the average price of a group of commodities. The transitory effects of weather and other factors affecting production and prices of individual commodities tend to average out. Secondly, the use of many commodities makes it more difficult for any trader or political entity to manipulate the value standard for his or her own advantage." Close quote. In determining what commodities should be included in the basket, Greco suggests the following criteria. They should be 1. Traded in several relatively free markets. 2. Traded in relatively high volume. 3. Important in satisfying basic human needs. 4. Relatively stable in price over time. And 5. Uniform in quality or subject to quality standards. Merchants using the credit clearing exchange could agree to accept payment in a national currency, but the amount due would depend on the currency's value in relationship to this commodity-based unit of account. Once the unit had been established, the value of any currency could be determined in relation to it, and exchange rates could be regularly computed and published for the benefit of traders. Bernard Leiter has proposed a commodity-based currency that he calls new currency, which could be initiated unilaterally by a private central bank without the need for new international agreements. The currency would be issued by the bank and backed by a basket of from 3 to 12 different commodities from which there are existing international commodity markets. For example, 100 new currency could be worth 0.05 ounces of gold plus 3 ounces of silver plus 15 pounds of copper, plus 1 barrel of oil, plus 5 pounds of wool. Since international commodity exchanges already exist for those resources, the new currency would be automatically convertible to other national currencies. Leiter has also proposed an exchange system based on a basket of commodities standard that could be used privately by merchants without resorting to banks. Called the Trade Reference currency, TRC, it involves the actual acquisition of commodities by an intermediary organization. The details are found on the TRC website at www.terratrc.org. TerratrC.org. So that's one idea. Another idea is valuing currencies against the Consumer Price Index. Money reform advocate Frederick Mann, author of The Economic Rape of America, had another novel idea. In a 1998 article, he suggested that a private unit of exchange could be valued against either a designated basket of commodities or the Commodity Research Bureau Index, the CRB, or the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. Using standard price indices would make the unit particularly easy to calculate, since the figures for those indices are regularly reported around the world. Mann called his currency unit the Riegel after E.C. Riegel, who wrote on the subject in the first half of the 20th century. For the basket option, Mann proposed using cattle, cocoa, coffee, copper, corn, cotton, heating oil, hogs, lumber, natural gas, crude oil, orange juice, palladium, rough rice, silver, soybeans, soybean meal, soybean oil, sugar, unleaded gas, and wheat in proportions that worked out to about $1 million in American money. This figure would be divided by 1 million to get one Riegel, making the Riegel worth about $1 in American money. Another option would be to use the Commodity Research Bureau Index, which includes gold along with other commodities. But Mann noted that the CRB would give an unrealistic picture of typical prices because individuals don't buy those commodities on a daily basis. A better alternative, he said, was the Consumer Price Index, which tallies the prices of things routinely bought by a typical family. In the United States, CPI figures are prepared monthly by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Prices used to calculate the index are collected in 87 urban areas throughout the country and include price data from approximately 23,000 retail and service establishments and data on rents from about 50,000 landlords and tenants. When Mann was writing in 1998, the CPI was about $160. He suggested designating one Riegel as the CPI divided by 160, which would have, again, made it about $1 in 1998 prices. Converting the cost of one Riegel's worth of goods in American dollars to the cost of those goods in other currencies would then be a simple mathematical proposition. The CPI's core rate, which is used to track inflation, currently excludes goods with high price volatility, including food, energy, and the cost of owning rather than renting a home. But to be a fair representation of the consumer value of a currency at any particular time, those essential costs would need to be factored in as well. These proposals involve private international currency exchanges, but the same sort of reference unit could be used to stabilize exchange rates among official national currencies. Several innovators have proposed solutions to the exchange rate problem along these lines. Besides Michael Rowbotham in England, they include Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, the Malaysian Prime Minister credited with sidestepping the Asian crisis that brought down the economies of his country's neighbors. The Middle Eastern news outlet Al Jazeera describes him as a visionary in the Islamic world who has proven to be ahead of his time. As noted earlier, Islamic movements for monetary reform are of a particular interest today because oil-rich Islamic countries are actively seeking alternatives for maintaining their currency reserves, and they may be the first to break away from the global bankers' private money scheme. In international conferences and forums, Islamic scholars have been vigorously debating monetary alternatives. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. In 2002, Dr. Mahathir hosted a two-day seminar called The Gold Dinar in Multilateral Trade, in which he expounded on the gold dinar as an alternative to the U.S. dollar for clearing trade balances. Islamic proposals for monetary reforms have generally involved a return to gold as the only sound currency, but Dr. Mahathir stressed that he was not advocating a return to the gold standard, in which paper money could be exchanged for its equivalent in gold on demand. Rather, he was proposing a system in which only trade deficits would be settled in gold. A British website called Tax-Free Gold explains the proposed gold dinar system like this. Quote, "It is not intended that there should be an actual gold dinar coin or that it should be used in everyday transactions. The gold dinar would be an international unit of account for international settlements between national banks. If, for example, the balance of trade between Malaysia and Iran during one settlement period, probably 3 months, was such that Iran had made purchases of 100 million Malaysian ringgits and sales of 90 million rials, the difference in the value of these two amounts would be paid in gold dinars. From the reports of the Malaysian conference, we deduce that the gold dinar would be 1 ounce of gold or its equivalent value," closed quote. At the 2002 seminar, Dr. Mahathir conceded that gold's market value is an unsound basis for valuing the national currency or the prices of national goods because the value of gold is quite volatile and is subject to manipulation by speculators, just as the U.S. dollar is. He said he was thinking instead along the lines of a basket of commodities standard for fixing the gold dinar's value. Pegging the dinar to the value of an entire basket of commodities would make it more stable than if it were just tied to the whims of the gold market. The gold dinar has been called a direct challenge to the IMF, which forbids gold-based currencies. But that charge might be circumvented if the dinar were actually valued against a basket of commodities, as Dr. Mahathir has proposed. It would then not be a gold currency, but would be merely an international unit of account, a standard for measuring value. Other Islamic scholars have been debating how to escape the debt trap of the global bankers. Tariq El-Diwani is a British expert in Islamic finance and the author of The Problem with Interest in 2003. In a presentation at Cambridge University in 2002, he quoted a 1997 United Nations Human Development Report underscoring the massive death tolls from the debt burden to the international bankers. The report stated, quote, "Relieved of their annual debt repayments, these severely indebted countries could use the funds for investments that in Africa alone would save the lives of about 21 million children by 2000 and provide 90 million girls and women with access to basic education." El-Diwani commented, quote, "The UNDP does not say that the bankers are killing the children. It says that the debt is. But who is creating the debt? The bankers are, of course. And they are creating the debt by lending money that they have manufactured out of nothing. In return, the developing world pays the developed world $700 million per day net in debt repayments." He concluded his Cambridge presentation, quote, "But there is hope. The developing nations should not think that they are powerless in the face of their oppressors. Their best weapon now is the very scale of the debt crisis itself. A coordinated and simultaneous large-scale default on international debt obligations could quite easily damage the Western monetary system and the West knows it. There might be a war, of course, or the threat of it, accompanied perhaps by lectures on financial morality from Washington, but would it matter when there is no little left to lose? In due course, every oppressed people comes to know that it is better to die with dignity than to live in slavery. Lenders everywhere should remember that lesson well. Close quote. We, the people of the West, can sit back and wait for the revolt, or we can be proactive and work to solve the problem at its source. We can start by designing legislation that would disempower the private international banking spider and empower the people worldwide. To be effective, this legislation would need to be negotiated internationally, and it would need to include an agreement for pegging or stabilizing national currencies on global markets. Well, that brings us back to the question of how best to stabilize national currencies. The simplest and most comprehensive measure for calibrating an international currency yardstick seems to be the Consumer Price Index proposed by Mann, modified to reflect the real daily expenditures of consumers. To show how such a system might work, here's a hypothetical example. Assume that one international currency unit, an ICU, equals the Consumer Price Index or some modified version of it, multiplied by some agreed-upon fraction. On January 1 of our hypothetical year, a computer sampling of all national markets indicates that the value of one ICU in the United States is $1. The same goods that $1 would purchase in the United States can be purchased in Mexico for 10 Mexican pesos and in England for half a British pound. These are the actual prices of the selected goods in each country's currency within its own borders, as determined by supply and demand. When you cross the Mexican border, you can trade a dollar bill for 10 pesos or a British pound for 20 pesos. On either side of the border, one ICU worth of goods can be bought with those sums of money in their respective denominations. Carlos, who has a business in Mexico, buys 10,000 ICUs worth of goods from Sam, who has a business in the United States. Carlos pays for the goods with 100,000 Mexican pesos. Sam takes the pesos to his local branch of the now federalized Federal Reserve and exchanges them at the prevailing exchange rate of 10,000 U.S. dollars. The Fed sells the pesos at the prevailing rate to other people interested in conducting trade with Mexico. When the Fed accumulates excess pesos, or a positive trade balance, they are sold to the Mexican government for U.S. dollars at the prevailing exchange rate. If the Mexican government runs out of U.S. dollars, the U.S. government can either keep the excess pesos in reserve, or it can buy anything it wants that Mexico has for sale, including but not limited to gold and other commodities. The following year, Mexico has an election and a change of governments. The new government decides to fund many new social programs with newly printed currency, expanding the supply of Mexican pesos by 10%. Under the classical quantity theory of money, this increase in demand, money, will inflate prices, pushing the price of one ICU in Mexico to around 11 Mexican pesos. That is the conventional theory, but Keynes maintained that if the new pesos were used to produce new goods and services, supply would increase along with demand, leaving prices unaffected. Whichever theory proves to be correct, the point here is that the value of the peso would be determined by the actual price on the Mexican market of the goods in the modified Consumer Price Index, not by the quantity of Mexican currency traded on international currency markets by speculators. And we'll continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.